Hello folks, welcome back, and if you're a new listener, welcome to the show. I'm your host Simon Ward, and you're listening to the High Performance Human Podcast. Now I've got something to tell you. You might not realise it, but you are a high performance human. It's not just about your fitness level and your race results. It's not even about how you compare with all of those other endurance athletes you work out with and race against. Being a high performance human is about your whole life performance. It could be sleep, nutrition, exercise, relationships, mental health, or a combination of all of those. And you don't have to be a high level athlete to excel at any or all of these. And we appreciate that you might still feel like you've got room for improvement in one or all of those areas. And so if you do, we'd love to help you. I've currently got availability to take on a few clients, and my wife Beth, who's a certified life coach, also has availability. So depending on what you're looking to focus on, we have you covered, and you can find contact details in the show notes. My guest today on the podcast is Jim Vance. There are a few individuals in the world with a teaching background, elite athletes experience, and coaching experience with elites, amateurs, and juniors, as well as the knowledge of training and a passion and understanding for tech. Jim's got a foot in all of these camps. He's been the coach to US pro triathlete Ben Canute now for 8 years, and he's also written 2 triathlon books, details of which you'll be able to find in the show notes. And he's a consultant to several tech companies in the multi-sport space, including 80/20 Endurance and Velocity, a software program for cycle coaching. Now, Jim and I have a great chat about the rapid advancements in technology through the last 20 or 30 years and their impact on triathlon training, racing and coaching. We also get into the weeds on the physical toll of triathlon racing for pro triathletes now, given the ever-increasing intensity and number of races on the calendar, and especially when racing in the extreme heat like they did at the T100 race in Singapore and Miami recently. Finally, and I think most importantly for you the listener, we discuss the significance of personal harmony and relationships in achieving optimal athletic performance, and the crucial role of mental and physical preparation in triathlon. So I hope you enjoy the conversation. Let's crack on with Jim. Okay, welcome to the show, Jim Vance.
Thanks, Simon. It's good to be here and, connect with you again.
Yeah, indeed. It's always a pleasure to have folks on from the far side of the world. It feels like that anyway, from California. Of course, my wife loves it because she feels like she's got some homies there on the turf with her.
I bet. Yeah, she's from right up the road, you said, I think, for me.
Costa Mesa. Yeah, so it's what, yeah, an hour, 90 minutes from you?
It depends on traffic.
you've always got to take traffic into account in California, yes, haven't you? Even when you're not in the city. It's great to have you on, Jim. And we've had a lot of coaches on, triathlon coaches and from different sports over the years, but I don't think many of them have got their fingers in quite as many pies as you have. And I don't mean that in a disparaging way. You sort of step across lots of things, all of which are interrelated. So you were a triathlete and a competitive triathlete as an age grouper and a pro. You've written books and you are very engaged in coach education. You are coaching now at the elite end of the sport. And you also have a passion and a real understanding and an ability to share information that people can use about tech. So if there was a few circles and we're drawing a Venn diagram, you, Jim Vance, would be stood right in the intersection of all those, I feel. Is that a sort of reasonable summary?
Yeah. No, I think you probably put it pretty well in that visual. I tell people I'm one of the few guys in the sport that has at one point or still does sit on all sides of the table, from the coaching side to the athlete side to the business side to the, the tech side. There's all sorts of different ways, even media. I mean, I've written articles, I've written books, like you said, so blogs and things. So yeah, I kind of see the sport from all facets, not just the training side or the coaching side, really understanding business and where the sport is, where it's going, what the opportunities are is what I'm always interested in looking at to grow the sport. You know, there's a lot of cool stuff that I've seen that athletes and coaches have yet to see, but I think down the road will be coming. You know, some of that tech is, you know, some companies just are no longer with us. Even though the tech, I was like, ooh, this is cool. Someone's going to get it at some point and bring it out. So, And even the tech that I've written about since the time we started has changed. Look at just look at running power meters. Goodness, they've changed. it's an entirely new world of tech and data in that compared to when I wrote Run with Power. So,
well, I can remember, you know, I was a few years into my triathlon journey when the first accessible heart rate monitors came out. But if you got one of the Polar 3000s, it was like wearing one of those huge Casio watches, you know, the ones with the big computers on there. And it was like carting a house brick around. But you thought that you were really ahead of the field when you had one of those.
Yeah. Oh, do you remember the first Garmins? They were like, they're as big as your forearm.
Yeah,
practically. On some tiny runners, that long piece.
Well, I can remember. I used to be involved with CompuTrainer back in the day, and we had this arrangement with Ironman to effectively video the bike course. And the first one we did was in Hawaii in about 2005 or 2006, and we drove the car with the cameras on the back, filming the footage, you know, and all the people. We were about 5 minutes ahead of the lead men. So we had the helicopter about a mile down the road, and we had all the aid stations out and the spectators. And we had five different GPS devices on the windshield, on the, you know, front of the dashboard, picking up the satellite. And these weren't bike computers. They were proper handheld, you know, almost like hiking GPS units from Magellan and Garmin and whoever else used to make them. Just so we can make sure that we got some accuracy there. And when we got back, each one of them measured a different distance. You know, they'd all been sat in the car, so they'd all traveled the same distance, but they all gave us different measurements. And then we had to fit the video to the course data so that when people were riding, you know, their CompuTrainer, it made it feel like they were riding uphill when they were actually climbing up to Harvey. But there was a bit of a lag in the data. So, when you looked like you were riding uphill, actually the resistance on the CompuTrainer was made it feel like you were going downhill. So everything had to be processed manually. But man, that collecting that data and then connecting it all and creating those videos was so time consuming. But it then made folly of this whole thing about people complaining that their, you know, the bike course was short or long because their data on their bike was wrong. But of course, it's getting that data off satellites, which are transmitting the information. And if the military don't want you to have that information accurately, then they can distort it. So,
yeah, there you go.
Yeah,
that's for sure. It's that whole world of data and tech. It's changed rapidly. Mm. I mean, think about it. You know, and now we live in a world where AI is, you know, accelerating exponentially in its abilities. So, you know, and I know everybody, especially in the coaching world, the AI theme is, oh no, AI. AI is going to help training, help us review training, help us in so many ways and new features that are unrelated to actually the relationship side of the sport that I think people don't recognize that, you know, that's going to be really good. You know, and what do those look like? Everything. There will not be a single area of the sport that isn't touched by tech and AI, from swim stroke analysis, bike analysis, even probably more live analysis of efficiency of position, things like those that we'll start to get into in the future. So, you know, if you're, you know, it's a great time to be alive. If you're really excited about tech and want that, there's always new great stuff coming. If you're more of a, you know what, I like to keep my life simple and my coaching simple and free from noise, you're only going to have a better platform to stand on because it's only going to get noisier. You know, so I think, you know, it's an amazing time in the sport, in our world. And, you know, I'm excited to see where we go next. I mean, you just look even on the professional side of triathlon racing. You know, I think most of your audience will know me as I've been Knut's coach for a while. You know, after we didn't have a very good race in Miami, you know, I did have to kind of talk him off the ledge a bit and say, you know, because he's like, Jim, man, like, this is just not good. And, you know, we have to recognize that we are in a time compared to where we used to be, where he could show up to a race and we only had to worry about 2, 3, 4 guys, maybe. Mm-hmm. Now he jumps on a race and he's got 19 other guys that are absolute world class, mm-hmm. you know, and what we're also finding too in the sport, what I'm finding is that because the races are getting more competitive and harder and there's more money on the line, guys are peaking for these events even more so. And so you can't train through these races as easily. And so what's literally happening now is because everyone is coming in more tapered, there's more money on the line. They're taking more risk. We've had 2 races on the T100 series that have been in extremely hot conditions, mm-hmm. forcing athletes to go much deeper, mm-hmm. which means recovery times are now extended coming out of these. And you know, a perfect example is Magnus Ditlev and Roth last year. Look at all the guys that competed at Roth. You know, so the whole world championship podium in Nice came, those guys competed at Roth, and it was an entirely different outcome. And the guy who did the best is the one who walked the marathon. The guy who did second best is the guy who set the world record for the marathon in the race. And the guy who did the worst out of those three is the guy who won the race and was so dominant, but dug himself in a hole.
Yeah.
You know, and struggled to come out of. And I think now we're seeing that as a whole, where recovery in the sport is becoming this fine, fine line. And it's incredible. So, you know, that is just the sport, how the sport has changed at the professional level in 2 years. So, and it's dramatic.
So there's a couple of things there. There was an article written by David Walsh, who you might be familiar with. He wrote Seven yeah. Deadly Sins and had that big sort mm-hmm. of, you know, thing with Lance.
So yeah.
He writes in the Sunday Times, and he'd written about if we pay players in sport more, they'll want to perform more, but then they'll be more tired and people will get injured more. And he was talking about professional soccer in the UK. You know, he was talking about England and the fact that England probably won't win the World Cup, even if they've got a team that could, or the European Championships, because they play so many games in the Premier League and in Europe that the players are just exhausted come the end of the season. And it's no wonder they underperform then. And then it's no wonder traditionally they underperform at the start of the next season, because they just haven't had any recovery period. He was talking True. About the big accident that happened in the Basque Country race recently in Pro Tour cycling, where Vingegaard and Revenepoel were both injured and taken out, you know, for several months now. And both of those athletes have been dominant. And he was saying that part of the reason there is because there's no hilltop finishes anymore, because the only places that can afford to have finishes are the towns. And so there's no hills to break the peloton up. So people are closer in the peloton. You know, the top 20 was only separated by a minute. So on the descents, people are taking more risks. And so what was a risky corner suddenly became a bad corner with 30 people coming in, and, you know, somebody made a mistake and everybody went down. And mm-hmm. so it comes, and then it comes back to what you were saying about in the T100. If you look at the world map of where these races are, the athletes are flying backwards and forwards. So it's not just the racing that takes its toll. It's the amount of travel time and the amount of time zone changes that people are going through. Is, you know, we seem to forget that because these people are elite athletes, they do have better powers of recovery, but they're still human and they're still susceptible at some point to everything else that a human body is susceptible to. And time zone changes are hugely a corrosive on the body and sleep patterns and recovery. And, you know, it's great for watching, but it's not so good for the athlete's long-term health and longevity.
I look at Yuri Kulin, who just mm-hmm. won Singapore.
Yeah.
My hat goes off to that guy. What a race. What mm-hmm. a performance. Mm-hmm. Good luck in your recovery. Like, I'm worried about him. I mean, that when you go that deep, I'm telling your audience, there is a cost that people cannot see and measure. Mm. And it has. And then here's the other thing, too. Let's add in super shoes. Let's add in tech. Because here's the thing. The distances haven't changed. it's still 100K. A 70.3 is still 70.3 miles. But when you add in better wetsuits, better swim gear, better rolling resistance, reduction, better aerodynamics, stiffer bikes, that means faster speeds. When you throw on super shoes, well, now you're running faster. So literally, even though the distance hasn't changed, the duration to cover that distance has changed dramatically in the last few years. And so what's happened then, as duration decreases, intensity increases. And because of that, now we are it's no longer the same race that we were training for a few years ago. We were working on different energy systems.
Yeah.
Now it's a different energy system, a little bit more taxed the other way. And so literally, these systems are not designed for recovery. They are very, very high intense. And so the sport is changing at the highest level, because it's even changing in the age group level. Now, different athletes, you can get away with less training now too. I'm trying to get athletes to see that. And you have to, because if you're truly training for it, you shouldn't be doing the same volume under the same intensity levels. You should be doing less volume and increasing your intensity and focusing on that. And that's really, really difficult for athletes to understand, because we're a sport of habits and old school thinking. And so, oh, well, I recovered at all. I only ever need 5 days to recover from a race. Well, guess what? That's no longer true.
Yeah.
And then you dig your hole, because you start back too soon.
Well, and of course, if we look back to the legends of the sport that we still, you know, look up to, because they're all still around, the Dave Scotts and the Mark Allens, they were doing big volumes, but the number of races they were doing a year and the ones they were having to peak for, well, you could count them on, you know, half of the fingers of one hand. And they didn't have to race around the world. They could afford to go to Nice and spend a few weeks there before racing, or they could afford to spend a month in Kona preparing for an event and chilling out and living up on the, you know, on the volcano. Not anymore. Not anymore. They, you know, and they wouldn't, and Dave probably wouldn't have been able to race into his 40s and Mark into his late 30s and have those stellar performances with the type of racing they'd be required to do today.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, that's where one of these things, sometimes these athletes don't understand when they have had an injury. Probably one of the benefits is that they finally really, truly are forced to recover. And they don't realize how tired they are until, I mean, it's amazing how comfortable you can get with discomfort at times. So just dragging.
You talked about tech a moment ago, and you know, thinking about all of the bits of data, we know triathletes, pro and age group, love tech, and they love collecting data. So they've got their bike power meter, they've got their form swim glasses now, they've got their heart rate monitor, they've got their stride running power meter, they've got the whoop of their Aura sleep ring, they've got the CGM, right? That's, I think I've mentioned about at least half a dozen different devices there, all of which are collecting data. Now, as a human being, if you're an athlete, I don't know how you have time to fit in your 15 hours of training a week and look after your family and do a job and analyze all that data. So you need a coach. But if you're a coach, you've got to be cognizant with each of those data deliveries, what it's telling you, how to break down the data, how you can use that to best effect. And it's not just a whole spreadsheet full of numbers. This is the benefit of AI, because the right AI programs are going to be able to help us crunch all that data and give us the important information and tell us the key things that, you know, the biggest levers that we can pull that are going to make a difference, and we can do something about it. And then that's how, as coaches, we can be that filter for the athlete. And then we have to use our understanding of that human that we're coaching about how they like to receive information, about how we question them to find out what they want and how we get feedback from them. That's the skill that as coaches we have. And that's the unique thing that we possess that enables us to still stay in that position despite AI. In fact, it's going to make our jobs easier and enhance what we do if we can get our heads around it.
Sure. Well, and I'll be honest, sometimes I think athletes and, you know, I don't think it's any, you know, any surprise. I've been talking about this for a long time, but I'm really about, you know, I care more about athlete mindset on the start line than I do about training. You know, and I think a lot of athletes get so number focused that they kind of get away from trusting themselves, and they almost can't see the forest for the trees.
Mm-hmm.
What I mean by that is, you know, I look back on my life, you know, when I was racing well, you know, was the training that much better? Sure it was, but you know what was more consistent? I was just in a good place in my life.
Aha.
Like I was happy. I didn't have a lot, you know, I didn't have some stressors, you know, like, and I'll give you an example. I coach one pro, and in the time that I've started coaching him, it's been, how long am I coaching now? About 16 months. You know, he went through a divorce, literally went from married, divorced, and, you know, separated, and, you know, and now in this. And it's been fascinating to watch. And I'm not advocating people get divorced or not. Like, I'm just sharing one thing. It's been interesting to see him. One, that relationship was stressful on him. And once he got away from that, it was amazing to see this change in him, where suddenly he really started to own more of his processes. He started to recognize that he needed to be happy within himself. He couldn't just rely on someone else. So it became much more of an inward journey for him. And it's just been incredible to watch his growth and clarity. Like, he doesn't get distracted anymore. He's very, like I say, ownership of processes. He likes freedom. It's almost like I'm no longer the coach now. He's in the driver's seat and he's telling me where to go, and I'm helping him plot the course instead.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's been amazing. And the only thing I can really track back to is just this lifestyle change. And the more and more I do it, Simon, the more I had a call with one of my pro triathlete females the other day. And I said, the only way we're really truly going to get where you want to go is if you and your husband have a wonderful relationship. Bar none, 100%. I can analyze files. I can write training. I can write the perfect plan. But in the end, if there's friction at home and there's stress there, doesn't matter. When you toe the line, you're going to be carrying that weight.
In the 7 years we've been doing this podcast, I've talked to quite a few pro triathletes, not as many as some podcasts, but nearly all of those, when I've asked them about what were the distinguishing points about their successful parts of their career, harmony and happiness, and just having a quiet life, just, you know, no conflict. I think Gordo Byrne talks about this as well, is, you know, how can you have a life without conflict? How can you avoid conflict? You know, how can you spot conflict coming in home relationships, with kids, in business, and avoid it so that it doesn't create undue stress? And I know a lot of people, and probably men more than women, but you know, like conflict, but conflict causes stress. You know, it's a fight or flight reaction, and that's creating cortisol and adrenaline. Well, we get enough of that when we're training. We need to be getting less of it, because it might be a little drip, like a little tap dripping, but if you leave a tap dripping for long enough, it creates a big puddle. And yeah, so that whole thing about harmony and happiness is, you know, you and I, sounds like we're on the same page here with this, because it's something that I chat with the athletes that I coach. And most of those are age groupers, very committed, operating at different levels. But harmony is something we talk about for athletic longevity and marital longevity and just health span, really.
Yeah. It's the hidden... It's the elephant in the room, right?
For sure.
How many athletes are running to triathlon to escape?
Yeah, well, I do wonder sometimes when I see people's training diaries, thinking, I wonder how you get to do that much training. Have you been given permission, or are you just hiding from something? Is it just easier to be training than doing the other stuff? Yeah. So, and
it's so true.
You know, I'm sure that there are pro triathletes out there who are, running away from whatever it is, and they have very good results, and we all look at them and put them on a pedestal and think, what a role model. But actually, if you, I know some that are like this, and I won't, you know, you probably do as well, so we don't need to say who they are, but you think, actually, these, if you knew about the backgrounds for these people, you wouldn't want them as a role model. It's, you know, they don't lead great lives. They just happen to be great athletes doing really well, but probably not sustainable either.
Oh, yeah. No, well, even in my own life and things, I've found that, you know, like you said, I've got my hands in a lot of pies, and I've had to really focus and recognize, like, okay, yep, no, need to focus on these pies right here. And, mm-hmm. and it keeps condensing down on these core things that I have. And mm-hmm. yeah. And in fact, that's my coaching approach too. Like to give you an idea, Simon, I'm basically at a point where I don't want to work with an athlete who won't go to therapy, because I just truly believe now that if you aren't the best person in, you know, where you are in your life, if you can't stand on the start line and say, I'm in a great place in my life, we're never going to maximize the training. Mm. We're never going to truly perform. Mm. You just, and I see athletes that, you know, when they go through these periods where they've reduced stress or gone through a stressful time, and they come back and they start to see these gains, they're like, wow. It's like, yeah, because now you let that go. You put yourself in an environment where you're supporting yourself and allowing yourself to succeed rather than inhibiting it. You know,
it's when you listen to the commentary sometimes on the T100 and the, you know, the PTO races, and you listen to the commentators saying, well, I don't know what they've done this year, but they've come back so strong and they're great. Belinda Granger actually nails it. She doesn't say, well, I just think they look happy this year, you know, but yeah. She's been there, hasn't she, Belinda? So she's probably got a better idea than most, but yeah.
I think Belinda is a great example of someone who had a long career because she had a lot of fun.
Yeah.
She and her husband, great people, very positive, always having fun, enjoying the mm-hmm. lifestyle and around, you know, they don't have kids, but they have dogs, mm-hmm. she and Justin. And, you know, just the fun that she has, you can still see. She still exudes positivity in her broadcasts and, you know, and how excited she is. And I think, mm-hmm. because she's been living her best life, you know, and I think that's why she had such a long career, even though she was a Sutton athlete who was doing huge volume and, you know, and, you know, life was probably a bit simpler back then when she was racing, you know, but she would probably say, but, you know, another example, I think in the end, you know, I hear a lot of people say, like, the, you know, the Norwegians are, well, I think you and I have talked about this, right? I'm always the type that says, what are our competitors doing? What are the holes in their approach? And how can we maximize those weaknesses in their approach? Mm. And one of the things that I've heard about the, you know, you can say the Norwegians, let's just throw them as a term, but I'm not classifying them or saying this is them, that you could substitute them for anyone else. But like, a group or people that go and they're so focused and they're so dedicated to their sport, and they, you know, they live like a nomad and they travel from race to race and or training camp to training camp, or, you know, it's their whole world. Well, so I look at that and I say, wow, that's great. And everybody fantasizes about that. But then I look at that and I say, what's the weakness in that approach? It's like your whole world is that. Where, how do you escape it? How do you, if something goes wrong, how do you handle the stress? Mm-hmm. Like, I look at, you know, I don't think anybody's surprised. Gustav Iden, man, what a stressful year that guy had. I felt like my heart really went out to Gustav after winning the world championship. It's like everything in the year just went down, from, unfortunately, his mother passing away to other things. And I looked at a guy that I thought was kind of lonely. Yeah, Euro Peter Reed. Yeah, absolutely. Peter was my coach when I was there. He was kind of a hermit, you know, a bit. So, you know, whereas, you know, but what did Peter do? He met an amazing woman, and you don't hear from him. He's living a great life just with her and doing his flying his planes. Yeah, mm-hmm. exactly. So, but, you know, I look at that and I'm like, does that mean having a family and a spouse is a disadvantage if it's an advantage to have that lifestyle? And I don't believe that. I think the opposite. I think we got to double down and go the other way. We got to dive into our relationships. We got to really enhance our world that brings more stability to it, that brings, that reduces stress, that it understands that when you toe the line, you've done all you can. And no matter the result, you walk away happy and proud that, hey, I've done everything I can. I'm doing the things right with my life. I'm in a great place. And if we're there, if I can get Knut to that spot in Kona, watch out.
Yeah, I think back to some of the people that I've coached as age group athletes that wanted to go to Kona. You know, there are certain things that I see that they all possessed. You know, they got the work done. They had quiet mm-hmm. lives. They didn't have lots going on. They weren't trying to be the party animal. They weren't bringing up five kids. They weren't launching three new businesses. They weren't trying to do 40 hours of training a week. They had a great relationship with their partner. They went to work. They focused on the work. And then when they came home, they got on with the training. And then that was it. They didn't go out a lot. But there was maybe four qualities. You know, they communicated with their partner a lot. So, yeah, it was stressful. But they had arrangements, right? Look, I'm going to train for Ironman here, but after that, we're going to go on holiday and I'm not going to train for anything and I'm just going to do 1 hour a day and we're just going to go on holiday and we're going to be back to normal. But they had certain key things. And then I see people looking out at them and saying, well, what are they doing that I'm not? Well, they're doing the same. I'm doing more training than them and I've got a bigger FTP than them. Yeah, but this is what they're doing that you're not. They're getting more sleep. Then they're not in. They haven't got their fingers in 15 different pies. They've got four or five things they're doing really well. Mm-hmm. And it's difficult, isn't it? Because it's not something that's done over a month or two. It's something that's done over, you know, most of those guys as well were patient, so they didn't have a 100-day plan. They had a 1,000-day plan to get to Kona, and you know, mm-hmm. and they were patient about seeing those improvements step by step, year over year, and getting closer to the goal. It's difficult, Jim. We've definitely disappeared down some rabbit holes, which I knew we would. But I want to find out how you got to this point. Okay, so what was
sure?
Where did you start off? You know, what were you doing at school? Were you an all round sportsman, or were you an endurance athlete? Were you a swimmer?
I was not very athletic, I joined the cross country team, kind of track team late my sophomore year of high school, 10th grade of 12. And it just kind of took off. By the time I graduated, I was a three-time All-State. I was recruited by a lot of big schools. I ended up walking on at the University of Nebraska for cross-country, indoor track, outdoor track. Left there, won two academic scholarships and earned a full ride scholarship. By the time I was finishing there, and it was a great time. I still had a lot of competitive fire, and I decided to move to San Diego after college, and showed up to town and didn't know anybody, didn't have a job, barely found a place to live on this new thing called the internet, and it was cool. And being here, you just get introduced to triathlon. And well, I didn't really know how to swim, so started swimming and learning that, and became pretty good. 2004 was like my first real season of triathlon, and I was Xterra Age Group World Champion overall. And then 2005, I was ITU Age Group World Champion in 25-29 men. And that was, I think I was third overall at the ITU Age Group World Championships, but had won the men. And then I got invited to join the U.S. national team at a camp here in Chula Vista at the Olympic Training Center for about 6 weeks. And I met Bobby McGee there, and he was mm-hmm. my roommate, and got to pick his brain every day, which was awesome. And as an athlete, and just learned a lot under Cliff English, who was kind of the national team coach at the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Cliff and I are still great friends to this day. Learned a lot under him. And then, right around that time, I'd been teaching. And I just, you know, I'd kind of was starting coaching, and I was realizing I was making as much coaching as I was teaching, and I wasn't really even trying. And I thought, you know, let me sell my condo, focus on this pro triathlon career, see how that goes, with the idea that I'll probably want to grow a coaching business. Cause coming from teaching, mm-hmm. that's what I did. And then I started working with Joe Friel, and Joe had me joining him for camps around the world and really focusing on the swim side. And then he and I did a book together, Triathlon Science. And then I wrote Triathlon 2.0 and Run with Power that he forwarded. And then, that's right around the time that I started coaching Canute, fresh after the Rio Games. And he came to me with kind of an interesting challenge that he wanted to, you know, win the 70.3 worlds. And he wanted to also win an Olympic medal in the mixed relay in Tokyo. And I thought that was a pretty crazy idea. This two different ends of the spectrum. Like, I don't know how in the world to do that, but You know, I was studying things like block periodization and conjugate sequencing periodization and object-oriented design type of approach. And in the end, I just said, yeah, I think I can do this. I think I can figure this out. But you know, it was interesting. I believed right then and there. I remember asking Ben a question. We were sitting in this little cafe, Moonlight or whatever, the one cafe that's there near the expo and in Kona. And I asked him, I said, Ben, how many races
Daylight, did you do? Daylight Mind.
Yeah, the Daylight Mind. Yeah. I think it's not there anymore. But he says to me, I was like, how many races did you do last year? He was like, you know, maybe 18, 20, something like that, 17, 16. I mean, it was ITU style. I mean, you had to do a lot. I was like, how many did you feel good at? He says, 2. I was like, whoa, dude. You mean 10% of the races you feel good at, 90% you don't? I said, I think I know what we got to do first. Is we just got to show up to the races and let you express your fitness. And then I've just always believed too, Simon, that we have a metric, every single one of us. And we probably don't even know what those metrics are, but we value them. And when we reach a certain threshold on that metric, we change as a person. And there's a lot of little metrics. Sometimes there's big ones. A little one might be something as simple as, you know, your neighborhood run loop, right? That you just go on and you run easy and you finish and you're like, wow, I ran that a lot faster than I usually do. And I didn't even try. Well, suddenly now that hits you. I'm fit. Like, I'm a lot fitter than I realized. Like, and now your confidence grows, right? Whereas, you know, if you're someone in the working world and boy, once I become manager, once I become a C-suite executive, once I make this much money, then I'm, man, my life changes. I'm this, I'm that. I buy this house in this neighborhood and now, you know, it's like, so what are those metrics? Can we identify them in an athlete's life and especially where they're most needed? And can we get them to pass that threshold to turn the switch? And that's what I knew I needed with Canute. I just needed him to believe he could do something that seemed impossible. Because if he didn't believe it, it wouldn't matter. And then lo and behold, he went on a run that's probably, in my opinion, one of the best runs in the history of triathlon. I mean, that just March, April of 2021 or 2019, when he went in 23 days, he won a 70.3 Oceanside, Barbados ITU and St. Anthony's Triathlon. Three entirely different races over different distances and different parts of the, the globe, in that short of a time against world-class guys. And I was like, man, we're on it. But literally all I did when we started was identify what are the metrics that are important for his goals. And I just had watched him watch those, gave him feedback on those metrics as he was training. And he just continued to see them improve. And by the time he got to Chattanooga in 2017 under me, he was in such a great place mentally, emotionally, physically. He was unstoppable. I mean, what he did in that race took a lot of courage that I don't think a lot of people realize, but he built that courage and that confidence in our approach. So I had this guy who was overrun. I was like, let me be conservative. Let me work slowly on the physical side, but make sure mentally he sees the improvement, build his confidence. And I said, you know, I'll see where this goes. And if the numbers don't continue to show that, then that's probably on me. And I got to figure out what to do next. So just became that. Go ahead. Sorry. I know I rambled.
No, it's fine. Can you remind folks what he did in Chattanooga, please?
Sure. He got second. He had a 4.5 minute lead off the bike and was only run down by Javier Gomez to win. And then ironically, the next year he took fourth behind in probably one of the greatest 70.3 races of all time when Jan won. Brownlee was second, Javier was third, and Ben was fourth. Ironically, if Ben has that run in South Africa, you put that run in Chattanooga and he's world champ in Chattanooga. 1 year difference. Yeah, we're just a little behind.
I mean, and that whole thing about, you know, somebody can turn up to a race in the best mental and physical shape, but there's nothing you can do about anybody else, is there? If they have the best race, you could have the best race ever. But if somebody else has the best race they've ever had, And apart from trying to impose your will on them psychologically and maybe making a break and trying to dominate and cracking them mentally, there's nothing you can do to stop their performance, really, is there, in triathlon these days?
Oh, there isn't. Oh, especially now. In fact, you know, I got to tip my hat to Sam Long. I mean, what he's doing right now is absolutely incredible. But you know what else? He's showing up to the line. Some of the things I've noticed, he has a life coach. He's in a great place in his relationship with his fiance. Mm-hmm. They have a new child at home. I see a lot of positive changes in Sam, and I see him racing more with confidence rather than with pressure. And then you add in the fact that, you know, I read his thing where he's like slow is or cool is fast, just keeping himself cool. One of the things that I told Canute about Singapore was that, you know, we're looking at a race where when we have a 20 meter draft zone, ideally we do. Mm. I'll just leave it at that. Do you need to go with the pack? I don't think you do. I think Sam Long did an incredible job of just in Miami and in Singapore riding his race, not raising his core temperature too much and just expressing his fitness when everybody else took too much risk and paid for it. And I think he's smart.
So that's a point that you've raised there about racing in the heat that I've had discussions with people regarding Kona. You talked about how the races have changed. I remember I went to every single Kona race with CompuTrainer from 2002 to 2019. And I remember around 2015 or 16, it looked like there was a complete sea change in the racing, that there was no longer Andy Potts out in front for miles on the swim. There was a group of seven or eight guys coming through out of the water together in swimming sort of, you know, 47, 48 minutes as well. But then they weren't taking the time in T1. It was like watching an ITU race. They were sprinting through T1 straight in. And I've worked in the swim exit as well. And I've watched these guys come through. And it is like, you know, straight under the shower, grab your bag, you know, top on, shoes on the bike already. And you're off. And then they're going around Kona like a procession, like an ITU race.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
If you're, and then I see other people who are in that second group a couple of minutes behind, busting a gut to try and get onto that train. But you've got to remember that in Kona, they're racing in water that's 26 degrees. It's already really warm at 6 o'clock when they're warming up by the pool. The heart rate's high because it's the world championships. And then they're racing really hard. You know, a lot of them are swimming harder than they would normally to try and keep up with the best swimmers. And then they're racing through transition. By now the sun's up and it's really warm in there. And their heart rate's 140, 150. So the core temperature's going up. It's no wonder big guys struggle in Kona with that. But if you try too hard to get to the front of the train, if you're at the back and then you can't afford to stop, so you've got to go 400 watts for 10 minutes to get past everybody to get near the front, you're cooked, aren't you? So your day's over because you're too hot and you're never going to bring your core temperature down at that point. So managing your temperature and your excitement level right throughout that morning from the moment you get up is absolutely critical in those hot conditions. And I don't think clearly some people do, but I don't think you really hear about that in terms of how the pros race and how they manage that. But it definitely plays a huge part in the event. And if you can manage your own pace, come out of a group, the swim group a bit further down, ride your own ride and then come through and then ride through on, you know, and then run through from a position of 10th to 15th, you're probably in a good spot.
Well, and it's going to be interesting this year too in Kona, because now that the race is going to be later, the end of October, how is that going to affect conditions? Mm. I think you're going to see 725 to 730 for the winter in Kona this year. Mm. That's what we're preparing for, that we have to be prepared to compete against, somewhere between 725 and 730.
I've never been there in at the end of October. Then do the winds drop, or does it get cooler? Not much, I wouldn't have thought, in a couple of weeks. I hope you're enjoying the show so far and learning a lot. If you aren't already a regular listener, I hope you feel you might come back. Please make sure to hit the subscribe button so you know whenever a new episode arrives. I publish these twice a week, ad-free, and with the mission of improving the health and performance of endurance athletes around the world. And to help me, I'd love it if you could share the episode with one person you think could benefit. If you have a couple more minutes, perhaps you could leave me a review on your chosen platform once you've finished listening to this episode. Okay, let's get back to the show.
Well, I mean, just look at what just look at what the difference has been in the men starting a few minutes earlier, 20, 30. Instead of a 7 a.m. start or 6:45 start, now they start at what, 6:20, 6 mm-hmm. something like that. Mm-hmm. Just that little bit and what that's meant to winds out on the mm-hmm. course and temperatures on the run, because mm-hmm. they're that much, you know, that's that makes for, by the because they're going so much faster on the bike. And starting sooner, they're literally starting the run about an hour earlier than they used to. Mm. So that's keeping the temperatures down and maybe at letting the sun come in a little bit more. So, or the cloud cover protect them. These little things though, they start adding up. And so we don't know the answer to your question, but I gotta think it's probably only going to improve performances in Kona this year. Now next year, I think the women come back and play and they're back on like the normal day. So it could just be a one-off, who knows? And I could be totally wrong. It could just be the hottest day ever with the way the world climate's going, but it's going to be interesting to see. Like I said, we're preparing for a world record performance practically in Kona, in terms of what we feel we need to have to compete against in terms of trying to be able to come as close to. And then, right, it becomes those X factors. Who came, you know, what are those little things that show up in the last hour of the race? Mm-hmm. You know, that stress you've been carrying, that load, did you actually rest enough? You know, and this is the thing, if I can get Ben to be in a wonderful place in his life, and we show up with B plus A minus fitness, I'll take that. I will, because that means he's confident in his approach and where he's at and his preparation and will perform well. Will that be good enough to win? Anybody who says they're going to win that race, don't trust them. it's crazy.
I've seen Lionel. I love Lionel like most people do, but I always wonder about his races. He's not the best swimmer compared to, you know, most of the top guys, the ones he's trying to race against. So he's in a position of disadvantage, but we talked earlier about, you know, being quiet on the bike, having a nice solid position and just not moving and looking planted. And yet Lionel always looks like he's trying to fight the bike. And, you know, I just wonder, nobody disputing the raw power he's got, but I wonder how much extra energy and heat he's creating by the way he rides and he swims, which, you know, sure, he can make up for some of that with his mental toughness, but eventually when your temperature gauge is going up and you're running out of energy, because of course that's another thing, when your temperature's higher and your heart rate's higher, you're not necessarily burning fat anymore. You're not fat metabolizing as efficiently, you're burning glycogen. So there's only so long anybody can keep going at that pace before they blow up.
Sure.
So I wonder if that's the reason why Lionel always has such a hard time in Kona compared to some more temperate places where core temperature isn't quite as critical.
Well, you know, I don't think it's the same Lionel anymore. I'll be honest. What I saw on Oceanside, that's not the same Lionel. I see a guy that finally, and I heard he has a new coach consultant. I won't dive into any details on that, but he's getting some pretty good advice from what I understand, which clearly must be because of what we saw on Oceanside. And, you know, his swim improved. But I saw a guy that went away and really focused on getting better. And, you know, I also, like, when I watch his thing, what does he have at home? He's got a great relationship with his wife. He's got a great, you know, a newborn in the house. It's bringing new happiness, probably a new sense of drive and motivation. So, you know, go back to the key moment of change in like a Macca career or in a Crowe career. It was right around the time they had children, believe it or not. You know, because suddenly they had something that grounded them a little bit more, kind of, you know, and that's not to say every single athlete who's had a child has gone on to do great things. Trust me, I know. But You know, it's how they handle that and how did those relationships and dynamic work? Because I'll be honest, I've had plenty of great athletes under me that have failed. And and generally those failures have had nothing to do with the training. Mm-hmm. Like when we really come down to it, well, Jim, you know, you didn't know it, but I'm an alcoholic. Well, Jim, you didn't know it, but you know, my son or daughter has a drug problem. Mm-hmm. Jim, I'm going through a divorce. I have body image issues, Jim. Jim, I have an eating disorder. Jim, you know, it's like, I kept going through all that. I'm like, man, like what training am I supposed to give to solve those problems? I can't. There's nothing. And so in the end, this probably isn't what people expect when they come to a show where Jim Vance the data and writes about all the tech says, screw all that. Just make sure you're surrounded by people you love and have a wonderful relationship with. So you can actually enjoy training.
But I think, you know, you go back, you talked about Belinda there. Belinda was a Compu Trainer sponsored athlete. And every time I met Belinda, I thought, God, she just looks so happy and enjoying life. You know, she just loves racing, like a lot of people say they do, but I think she really does. You know, I know Lucy Gossage quite well, who's raced in the UK. I don't know if you know Lucy, but she always looks like she's always got a smile on her face, but she is that person. She's always happy. She just loves being out there. She is just happy with life. It might not be what people expect when they come and listen to a podcast with two coaches who are quite well known and, you know, want to listen about power meters and, all of that other stuff. But actually, when you come down to it, those things will only get you so far if you're not happy and loving exactly what you're going to do and are doing and loving life.
Well, and what kind of coach would I be if I didn't really start with the basics and the foundation? Mm-hmm. You know, like, man, I see this in kids a lot. Like, no wonder they're anxious. Their worlds are full of disorganization. They don't know what's going to happen next because they're always chasing the next thing. It's like in my house, like, no, organization, structure, expectations, understand, have something you can count on. Yeah. It's like, I tell if you're 5 minutes late to something, you could have been 10 minutes early. Mm-hmm. Your life is just so disorganized that you don't know, like, you're just, and that's creating stress. That creates stress. Oh man, you're rushing. It's like, slow down. My wife was taking me to the airport a few weeks ago. And I kid you not, we were going to get to the airport 2.5 hours early just because she had something that she wanted to get to that was on the other side of town. So I was like, oh, we'll just go early. No rush. Well, we got in stuck in traffic at the airport because of construction. Mm-hmm. It was incredible, the stress response I felt. Mm. I was still 2 hours early. You know, and I'm like, man, it's just traffic does that. You know, I'm like, this is silly. Like, and it's all perspective, you know, like once I was like, I should just enjoy the time with my wife in the car. Mm-hmm. But what do we got anxious? And it's like, boy, the way we look at things.
Have you watched the documentary called The Blue Zones?
Yes.
Right. So that for anyone who's not watched it, it's looking at these pockets of population around the world where you've got a higher than average number of people that live into 100. And they went, I can't remember what the guy's Dan Butner, I think it is, that did the show on Netflix. But he went around the world to look at these and, you know, he was trying to show this sort of little clock of all of these habits that they had and things that they were following. But he hung out with them and it seemed like, well, they were all doing home cooking. They all lived in rural places where they hadn't really been touched by Western society, you know, fast food, you know, all of those other things. But a lot of those folks, they had community. They felt that they were wanted within the community, even though they were old, which in some parts of the world means, well, we'll put these old people in a nursing home and we'll go and visit them once a week. And, you know, we can feed them mashed potatoes and that sort of stuff. All of these people still living in a community. They still had friends. They still had a purpose in life, whether that was looking after an allotment or taking care of great grandkids or looking after the neighbors. They were still cooking and using real food. They weren't training every day. They were active, weren't they? They were still active and doing all that stuff. But it seemed to me like some of the keys were that sense of purpose and just remaining active and being part of a community, which is sort of very similar to what we've talked about today, you know, being just part of a loving group of people and feeling like you're wanted and you can contribute to that. Well, that's exactly what we're talking about in about harmony in the household, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And you can just see, if you don't feel that, or if you feel it clearly, how powerful that is. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, like someone says something to you that you could take one of two ways. You could take it, you know, maybe jokingly, or you could take it personally, you know, like that's probably comes back to what your baseline is. You know, is your baseline stressful that you feel like, you, I don't know, you, inadequate or not loved or not, you know, there's something missing in your life that's grounding you from being able to say, I'm good enough. Hmm. This workout doesn't have to be a PR. I can just check the box and move on. But what happens? We get athletes that have some sort of, there's something going on in their personal life, so they seek redemption in the triathlon space or in the training endurance space. And so they push and they push and they want, yes. And it's like, you don't, that has a toll too. Like that's an emotional toll. And you only, you know, you can only go to the thing. That's honestly probably one of the biggest things when I start working with really good triathletes is getting them to understand, like, I'm going to ask you to do some really good work and it's going to be intimidating at times. I'm also going to ask you to trust me and really rest. And then when you come into these hard sets, you can't get emotionally lost in it. You just need to check the box and move on. Don't feel like set this expectation. Just check the box, move on, stack your days. Because if I'm doing it right and I'm progressing it right, it will be successful naturally. If I get that stress recovery cycle, and when I say stress, I mean like as in load and from a training stress. Mm. Now that recovery cycle is so important to me. So what affects that recovery cycle? Mm. Home life, stress outside of it, nutrition, sleep, all those things probably come back again to relationships in your daily life and how they are. Mm.
Yes, keeping life simple, keeping life harmonious. It sounds too easy, Jim. But it's not.
Everybody just sing Kumbaya and Kumbaya, get some
that's right. We'll have a campfire and all sit around holding hands and singing at night. And exactly. Let's come back to you, Jim.
Sure.
We've talked a lot about harmony and relationships and simplicity and tech. How many of these things were you doing when you were competing as an athlete? Because you did have a time as a pro athlete, didn't you? And you got some pretty respectable results. Or are these things that you weren't doing as an athlete that you've reflected on since and thought, actually, maybe I could have done better?
You know, I think the biggest takeaway from my career, Simon, was actually that my best races and my worst races really didn't have much to do with training. It had to do with what I was thinking on the start line, that internal dialogue. And so, you know, just as I've grown up and matured in my life, you know, I mean, so in 2006, I did Ironman Florida. I got third. That was my first Ironman ever. I did 8:37, and which ironically, Canute did 1 hour faster in Raw. So that's how far the sport's come in a while. From just in that career, that really was what I noticed. Like when I was in in these good places and on the start line, happy with where I was, confident, you know, not really stressed, things did well. And so now back then I was single or seeing my wife to be, and we didn't have kids yet. My life was simpler, but you know, I still created stress. We all have stress in our lives, right? At some point. That was probably the biggest takeaway. And then, and really looking back, and I remember for real one time, you know, I was so big on CTL and trying to get that up, and I just wasn't really performing well, even though my CTL was the highest it had ever been. And then Joe said, well, it was just an off comment Friel made to me that changed my entire approach. And he said, well, that's why I tend to want to look at, you know, as he called them, top tens or top performances, and how do your performances rank recently compared to historical for certain durations and metrics? And so that's really when I started realizing, you know what? I'm not looking at performance. I'm just looking at load. I got to look at performance to drive load decisions. And once I started instead of looking at training as load, but more as trying to drive performance, I started looking at factors outside of training and realizing the effect they had. Everything from nutrition and hydration to, you know, to mental state, confidence, sleep, you know, just habits, lifestyle, the way people talk. I can tell you, one of my jobs when I do travel with Canute is keep certain people away from him. Mm-hmm. Because they're negative Nancy's. I gotta make sure that I like, nope, that my job is to keep them away and him away from and focused in his bubble so that he doesn't have any distractions. So yeah, I think a lot of people could use that type of help.
Yeah, it's interesting that, isn't it? It's, you know, I know people say to me, what do coaches actually do? You know, when you've got 3 days to a race, all the training's been done. What can a coach do there? Well, actually, it's just making life as simple as possible, mm-hmm. and keeping their mind focused on what they need to be and making sure they don't get too distracted. I used to see it a lot in the expo at Kona with, you know, you'd be there from the moment the parade had finished right through to, you know, Friday before race day. And I'd see some pros wandering around day after day. I remember talking to one English guy and you know, it was the Thursday, and he probably should have been going to the pro briefing or press conference, but he was in the expo wandering around at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It was, you know, how hot it gets there. And I said, what are you doing here? Shouldn't you be resting, putting your feet up? Because no, if I get a good result this year, I need to tap up some sponsors for next year. You know, I'm like, well, if you stay here too long, you aren't going to have a good result on Saturday, you know, so it won't make any difference. Mm-hmm. But you know, somebody should have been getting in his ear and saying, you know, set the meetings up early in the week before you come out, be organized, make sure the meetings mm-hmm. are in a quiet place, in the cool, rather than wandering around and getting tired. But, you know, and so many age groupers just wandering around day after day because they were bored, because they, you know, they'd got all this excitement, then they need to lose it instead of just sitting and being quiet.
One of the things when I went to Roth, I was a little worried sometimes. Maybe I wasn't as organized as Ben. You know, Ben was like, hey, we'll leave by X time. And I'm still grabbing my stuff and throwing it back. And he's like, are you ready yet? I'm like, sorry, man. I'm not used to this.
So, let's talk about you having this foot in these camps and being at the center of this sort of Venn diagram. And particularly, sure. Let's talk about tech. You've been involved with some really interesting tech developments. You were helping Stride out right from the early days, weren't you, with development and I guess advising them on coming into the market. Is that right?
A little bit. I was trying to more. I couldn't necessarily work specifically for Stride as I wrote the book. Obviously, I was learning from them and trying mm-hmm. to drive more of the future of the sport from a perspective of use. Mm. In the writing. So I, you know, obviously I think their product is kind of the standard in the sport right now, and in the tech space. So I've enjoyed that with them. And I like the even more stuff that they're doing. It's just, they're really advancing that product. I worked with Today's Plan for a while, which we were acquired by Specialized, before Specialized kind of decided to really just absorb the tech. They've shut down the public access to the cloud tech that was Today's Plan. So now it's just an internal Specialized kind of tech. But that tech was really amazing, and it taught me so much about what's possible for business growth with tech. The reason Specialized purchased Today's Plan was because our cloud tech was the engine behind the Specialized Ride app, which allowed. So if I'm an athlete, I walk into a bike shop and I buy a Specialized bike and I walk out with that bike, how does Specialized maintain a relationship with me? Mm. You know, when I buy a, you know, if I buy like a Tesla, I have a relationship with Tesla. You know, I, they're able to, you know, monetize that relationship, make sure I have a great experience while using the vehicle. It's the same thing. Mm-hmm. And that means I'm more likely to probably come back and buy a Tesla again. Same mm-hmm. thing with Specialized. What they found was athletes who used this app that connected them with other riders, built a sense of community, gave them tips and just made the experience better. Suddenly they came back and bought more Specialized bikes. And so they realized that this tech had a really great place. And it just kind of goes back to that sense of community and what people are looking for. I work for another company called Velocity now, which is kind of a platform that allows coaches to teach cycling instruction and challenge athletes with some really cool. It's kind of like, as I would describe it to the layman, like a, imagine if a triathlon coach had the power of Peloton at their fingertips to be able to connect with you and coach you and teach you. And so I've got that. And then I also am one of the partners with 80/20 Endurance, where I'm, you know, bringing this tech, this Velocity tech in and some of these other things. And it's been, it's exciting. It's really, really trying to just take that stuff and put it in, because I'm trying to deliver to athletes an experience that's a lot more interactive and engaging and does build community. Mm.
It's interesting, isn't it, that, you know, there's a lot of tech developments now. And I know some coaches that I work in British Triathlon as a coach educator, and we're working with the high performing coaches. So the ones like USAT level 3, a lot of those coaches want to get in on the tech and they want to be in on everything, but there's so much now. If they try to learn about all the new pieces of tech, they're going to spend so much time on that they're going to take their eye off the ball with their athletes and all those sort of harmony and relationship mm-hmm. building things that we've talked about. But we talked about your investing as well, and, you know, that interest of yours. And if you're an investor in business and you're putting money in as a business angel on a startup or something like that, you have to be understanding of the fact that you're probably going to get 9 failures for one success. Or like one of my clients says, you're gonna have to kiss a lot of frogs to get a princess or a prince, right? So yeah. when you're a coach and you're seeing all these tech developments, if you're keen and you've got an interest in tech like you are, how do you know which ones are going to be the ones that actually have some legs and travel, and which ones are going to fall by the wayside? Because you could spend an awful lot of time wasting energy learning about something. Like, let's say Super Sapiens, great idea, probably just not the right timing, but now it's no longer functioning. So all of those athletes that were buying into it aren't able to use that information they were getting. So if you'd invested your time learning about that, it's not lost, but, you know, you're not able mm-hmm. to use it now for productive means. So it's a long way of asking, how do you know which ones to follow and which ones to leave alone?
You know, it's a good question. I faced a similar question when I look at lactate. You know, lactate's popular. There are some coaches and athletes that swear by it. But I, you know what I found? I should just ask the athlete. And if I can't get an accurate answer from them, that's probably their first problem. Like, what is this effort level? Versus things like that, you know. And so I don't want to invest my energy in learning lactate. I really don't. If an athlete tells me, well, I really want to do a lactate test, okay, let's go do it. Let's find somebody that really knows it, that's near you, and let's get a test done and see what they say. But other than that, like, so I'm not afraid of it. But I think, I think the sport has a lot of egos. And I would say one of my advantages in the sport, like I say, is I always try and look at how people are doing things and what can I do to be different. So if there's a lot of egos, how can I be without ego? Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's actually Crowe's company, right? Sans ego, the coaching, which means without ego. I try to be humble and go to experts. That's why when I, you know, like I coach Canute, I have Matt Pendola, I have Bobby McGee, I have myself, I have Park McGlynn on that staff that I can go to and just, hey, give me your thoughts. Tell me what you guys think. Where, you know, they all kind of have input. So I try to leverage people more so than tech. I just try to make sure that and quantify with tech so that we can say, okay, here's what the data says. Do we all agree? Nope, we're missing this. Here's where we need to go. Or, hey, let's all, I think it's this. What do you think? You know, a perfect example of this is, let's take Miami. Ben did not have, Canute did not have the best race in Miami. And in fact, he was quite upset after the race. And I was kind of at a loss. I'm like, this was not how this was supposed to go. And only to find out that Matt's like, okay, well, it's Jim, there was something that I saw on a little test, but I didn't want to press for it. But anyway, what we found was that his hips, he had been doing some strength work and he just kind of aggravated his SI joint a little bit. Mm-hmm. And so it changed the entire way that he sat on the saddle. Mm-hmm. And Park was able to show us the sensor pads on his saddle from mm-hmm. prior to now. And you could just see how he's really leaning more to one side. And it was putting a lot more stress on his hip flexors. And therefore, it was no surprise that his power output just greatly decreased through the race because he could not sustain that effort because he wasn't utilizing the right muscle groups. Mm-hmm. And everything was going great in training until that point, that little thing. And we lost it. We call it internally and within our group, we call it structural integrity. We lost structural integrity. So literally all the work that we did from Miami to Singapore was all about maximizing structural integrity and not doing any work beyond what would sacrifice that. How did we know what that was? Well, we had to use Matt, the Pendola, to help show, hey, here's where he's at. Here's how he's progressing. These are getting better. We use Ben to tell us how it feels. Is it feel like it's getting better? Can he feel how that is? Does he feel more connection with the bike? So now we look at the data. Does the data support what we all think? And that's how we use it. And it's a team effort. And so when we talk about tech, like I'm always looking for tech that helps the team as a whole, first and foremost. And then when we need to, we can dive into it. Or I let Park come in. Like I don't have access to the tech Park does. His aerodynamic stuff. And I mean, what a vital member of our team, Park McGlynn is. If anybody ever wants to go see him, Cyclologic in Scottsdale, he's amazing, I think, you know, with what he's been able to do. And in fact, Park was like, well, Ben's tight here and tight here. We're literally on a FaceTime call. Ben with Park, Matt in Reno, me in San Diego, all together on one call. Mm. Park puts Ben on the table, runs him through some exercises that Matt did, put him back on the bike. And Park's statement to Matt was, I knew what you were trying to do. I just couldn't believe it would work that well. And wow, it really worked. And it's like, now we get it. But we don't get that with tech alone.
Sure. So that's something that we talk about in coach education. I know that, you know, we maybe talk about your sort of thoughts on coach education as well, because I know that's something you're hot on. But again, a lot of the younger coaches are enthusiastic. I want to be a swim coach. I want to know about video analysis. I want to coach people with power meters. I want to be a strength coach. I want to be a nutritionist. Like, there's enough experts out there that are brighter than you on all of those things that are willing to help build relationships, build teams, put your ego away and understand that, you know, somebody needs to be the project manager and you need to get people that are smarter than you. Most people who build big companies are not the smartest men in the room, but they know how to find the smartest men in the room and harness their talents to build something huge. Richard Branson talks about that an awful lot about, you know, he said, all the people who run my companies are way smarter than I am, but he's still sitting on, you know, the Virgin name, isn't he? So he probably is still the smartest. But you know, all the best coaches that I've spoken to, and you've mentioned a few of them, and I talk about some of the coaches in the UK as well, Chris Jones, Malcolm Brown, and Jack Maitland. They've all been excellent at building teams. They've all had sans ego and understood that it's not about them, it's about the athlete, and we need a group of people to work together in harmony. Again, there's that harmony thing for the benefit of their athlete. it's the whole thing that made British cycling great was let's have all of the teams sitting around and like, okay, how's Bradley Wiggins getting on today? So the physio gives their report and the strength coach gives their report and the cycling coach gives their report. And then they all work together to do their, but he's not my athlete or your athlete. And I do feel like that's something, again, that smart, good coaches get and perhaps other people that wonder why they're not doing so well, perhaps don't get.
It's you know, it can be a fickle business too. That's part of it. You know, I've recently done a lot of just therapy on myself too. That's probably part of the reason why my philosophy is really changing. You know, I think that there is a, you know, you have to be comfortable with yourself. Mm-hmm. You have to be comfortable to say, I don't know the answers.
Mm-hmm.
A very interesting story. My business partner in 80/20, David Ward, he told me this story where he went to this, he was coaching a lot of Russians years ago. He was invited to speak at this conference for all these Russian coaches and things like that. And, you know, he's listening through the interpreter about everything. And, this, you know, they're asking this expert before him all these questions. And he gets up there afterward. But he's like, that expert knew all the answers and this and that. And he gets up. And ironically, this was when this was like 2010, I want to say, maybe, where he, or 11, he was presenting the data that he had provided for our book, Triathlon Science.
Mm-hmm.
And because he did a whole chapter on it and all the data he had collected, and these Russian coaches asked him questions and he said, well, you know, I don't really know the answer to that. But, you know, this is kind of what they say, or no one really knows. But, you know, he just kept getting all these questions and he kept saying, well, I don't know the answer. Like, and he said afterwards, like it became like this crazy thing where all these Russians just came up to him. Because it was so unusual for a male in Russian society to show vulnerability and say they didn't know something.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just so new to them. And I just laugh at that. It's cultural. That's not the culture I come from and what I believe. But, you know, David was true to himself, and that's who he is. If anybody didn't know David, great guy. But I think it goes back to showing like we live in this society where we don't want to show weakness.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I kind of come back to what I said at the beginning. I look at what everybody else is doing and I'm like, what are the weaknesses in that approach?
Are you familiar with Dr. Tommy Wood?
No.
He was working with a guy called Chris Kelly, Dr. Chris Kelly. They had a business called Nourish, Balance, Thrive. He's done some stuff with Greg Bennett, I think. Okay. But Tommy's a British doctor who's working up in Seattle, and a lot of his research is on brain injuries to infants.
Mm.
From falls and just from, you know, breathing difficulties in birth and that sort of stuff. And so he's doing all that research, but he's really big into ancestral living and strength training and lifting. And I've had Tommy on the podcast a couple of times, and he's fantastic. He's really, really easy to listen to. But he said the same thing you do. He said, if you've got a coach that doesn't say, I don't know, more than he tells you answers, you probably need to find somebody else.
It's true.
And so, you know, that was really significant to me. That whole thing about vulnerability that you've talked about there, that's amazing, because that's one of the things we do in British Triathlon is we talk to the coaches about vulnerability, about self-compassion. And that's something my brother's a courage coach, and he helps people with self-compassion. So he studied with Brené Brown. So I don't know if you've heard of Brené Brown, but I mean, she is huge now. Mm-hmm. If you look on TED Talks, she's got one of the most listened to. Her stuff is amazing, but it is all about vulnerability and self-compassion and learning to love yourself and you know, not being too hard on yourself. And I do feel like some of the triathletes I've come across have a hard time giving themselves an easy time. They call themselves out if they have a bad session. Back to that whole thing about, you know, you can't always perform, just sometimes get it done and move on. Give yourself permission to enjoy life. Give yourself permission to have a bad day. Give yourself permission to have a lie in if you want to, but show some self-compassion You know, because if it was an injured dog or it was your grandma, you wouldn't be forcing them to do some of the things you do.
Yes, it's true. Well, you know, and I come back to it. If you're so many times I see athletes on the start line and it doesn't matter the coaching job I've done workout wise, if they're not in a place to perform, and if athletes are truly honest with themselves, if they look back at their really bad races, they could probably predict it was going to go bad just by going back and thinking, what was I thinking on that start line? What was my internal dialogue? And, you know, because if it's negative or lacks excitement or just a positive outlook, an appreciation of being where they are, then they're probably going to race on their heels. They're going to race defensively rather than feel free to flow and be confident and make decisions. You know, I always like, it's just from that first step, it's like, I want an athlete to write out a whole race plan. You know, tell me what's going to happen from the time they wake up in the morning and even in the days leading into the race, but from the time they wake up in the morning to the time they cross the finish line. Sequence that day, go through it for me. What's your internal dialogue in the swim, at the start of the swim, the core of the swim, the end of the swim, T1, the bike, all these things. And then we take that and then I set it aside and I get them back to one specific thing, especially if it's an elite. First buoy, first buoy, first buoy. You get your ass to that first buoy and the rest will take care of itself. Because now they have this, they have the plan, they've gone through it. They just need to stay in this moment right now and focus and be successful in it. And if they have success in that moment, it's like this mental momentum, the snowball effect, where suddenly now they've put themselves in position. Their warm-up is probably a little bit more effective because they're more focused on starting the race well. Because it's more effective, they probably will start the race better. They'll get to that first buoy in a better position. Now they'll look around and probably see people that they didn't expect to swim with. Okay. I'm sure that's what Lionel noticed in Oceanside. He probably got there and was like, holy crap, there's Jackson Laundry. Like, I've never been this far in a swim with him. Like, I'm sure he knew that. And so suddenly his expectations of himself and what he's capable of rise. And now that snowballs into the next thing. It never really, like, you're just doing the training and the tech to get them ready for that moment. So many athletes train with just training and think, I just show up and it happens. No, you got to train for moments. You got to be prepared for moments. And that's what all this is for. And the most important moment is the start line.
That sounds very familiar and similar to the philosophy that Darren Smith had with his athletes. Oh, yes. Is focus on the process now. Let's not worry about
check
the outcomes.
The boxes.
Yeah, let's not worry check about the fact that you need a top 10 or a top 5 today. Let's just focus on, okay, what are we going to do? You know, what are we going to do when we wake up in the morning? What are we going to do going down to the start line? How are we going to warm up? Where are we going to position ourselves on the pontoon? Where are we going to position ourselves for that first buoy? You know, where are we coming out of the swim? And let's just be in the moment and not worry too much about performance and let's just see what happens. But as long as you execute well, as well as we know you can, then, and as we've talked about, then let's just let the rest happen because there's only so many things you can actually control, right?
I had a great conversation with Darren Smith one time where I was really at a point where in my coaching career where I just wanted my athletes to race aggressive. Throw caution to the wind and trust themselves and just go and race hard. And, you know, if we were going to make mistakes, we would make them being overly aggressive and, you know, and learn from there. But we would always try to put ourselves in a position to win early. And Darren came back to me with the exact opposite. He says, no, I would focus on just check the box, just work on that. And it really was one of those moments where I was like, okay, he's one of the best guys in the world. And he thinks the exact opposite of what I think. So, and he's had a lot of success. So I better rethink what I'm doing that was one of those moments that I take away and realize like, I'm, you know, it's the old more, 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 harder, 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 go, go, go philosophy that I was in. And it's amazing how I've just swung way the other way now.
I know you've got to go soon, Jim. So sure. Are you still keeping fit and working out regularly?
I'm running with my wife a lot more now. Mm-hmm. that's about it. Luckily, I've stopped drinking, so that's really helped my fitness. Actually, after we got back from Roth, I stopped drinking. I think I celebrated enough in Germany off our result and American record there, and with Knut, and ever since then, I just kind of stopped. And I've actually gotten away from racing. I wanted to maybe do Alcatraz again this year, but taking my own advice, I decided to reduce the stress in my life. And one of the stressors I had was feeling the need to prepare for a race and be competitive, because everyone, you're Jim Vance, you're then a pro, you should be great, you should be fast. And I'm like, you know what? I don't need that. I just need to go exercise and be a dad, be a husband, be a coach, enjoy the life. And yeah, so that's kind of where I'm at now.
And you know, all this tech that you're fond of, are you using any tech to optimize your own health and life and health span? Are you using sleep apps or CGMs to monitor blood sugar?
No, not CGMs, but I am using, I'm using a lot of the Apple stuff, a lot of the sleep stuff, just tracking, you know, the effects of that. And yeah, but mostly I've just been taking steps to reduce stress in my life, bring more structure, prioritize things that make me happy. And, you know, it's amazing how that's bleeding over into things like my coaching, you know, like my care and compassion for my athletes and their well-being, my ability to keep the bigger picture in terms of what I want to do, and and have honest conversations with my athletes. That's it's interesting too, because I'm in a really rare position, because this is my eighth season with Knut. I mean, think about it. When we started, he was like 24. This year he'll be 32. You know, so even the way I coached him at the start, he's not the same person. He's not the same athlete. I was telling someone, 8 years now, he doesn't need me. He doesn't. He knows what he's learned so much from me. Like but he likes the structure. He likes the relationship. He likes the everything. And so, you know, even the way that I coach and the way that I do with him, I'm still learning, because it's different. And his weaknesses have changed. His strengths have changed. So to have this type of experience over such a long haul is so rare, because most athletes are here and there, and I'm with this guy and then I'm done. And so it's just been an amazing journey for me.
I think that's a really good position to be in as a coach, is sort of to let an athlete know, look, I want to make myself redundant as soon as possible. I'm going to introduce you to lots of experts, share lots of knowledge with you so you can do things yourself. And because I'd like to get to a point where you don't need me anymore, but you just want to have me in your corner because it's better with me being there. And yeah, I think that's something I like to get to with all the athletes I work with, is build a long-term relationship, but get to a point where they don't need me, but they still choose to have me, because then the relationship becomes so much more relaxed and stress-free for both sides.
Absolutely. I always say that it should be a table. And if the only people at the table are the coach and the athlete, you don't really have a full picture.
No.
And everybody needs to be able to have a seat at the head of the table at least once in a while. And that's really what I'm doing in my thing, is really going and looking at athletes. Okay, who's at your table? And let's make sure everybody that's at the table has at least an opportunity to sit at the head of the table and be heard, and know that they're a part of this and the team. And, you know, things like spouses, things like, Matt Pendola, Bobby McGee, when we need certain things, as soon as we finish Alcatraz, I think we'll probably be heading to Reno, Knut and I, to visit Matt and let Matt sit at the head of the table for a little bit. And basically, hey, Ben, here's what we need to work on. It's clear before we start the next phase of training, because we really got to correct and get you structurally, have structural integrity, and make sure we're good and ready for the next block. So these are the, little things like that. We may give his wife seat at the head of the table. What does she need in their relationship and things like that? So yeah, exciting times. And it's kind of a new maturation for myself as a coach in the way that I grow. And I can see that I've slowly been plotting the dots towards this. It's just becoming more clear as I've worked on myself and gotten further into these relationships. And it's an exciting time.
Jim, I've got a whole page. Well, no, I've got three pages of notes here, and I'm probably going to have to make more when I go through the transcript. But if I can summarize it in a few simple words, I've got harmony. I've got simplify. I've got without ego. I've got building teams and relationships. And race day performance is as much, if not more, about your mindset than it is about your training and your CTL numbers.
Absolutely. Perfect. Perfect description.
So. Brilliant. It's not been the conversation I thought it would be. I thought we were going to get into tech and coaching, but I've enjoyed it immensely. And you've shared some amazing bits of wisdom. So I hope the listeners have enjoyed it as much as I have. And I'm sure we'll be crossing paths again and maybe chatting on the podcast. But for now, thanks so much for being here.
Oh, this has been awesome, Simon. Looking forward to more.
Thank you again to Jim for being my guest on the show this week. Jim pointed out about harmony and happiness being as important for race day performance as fitness. And that really resonates with me. It's not the first time I've heard coaches and athletes talk about this on the podcast. So maybe when you think about your next performances, have a reflect on some of your previous bests and see if they coincide with times when you felt happy and stress-free. You might be surprised. To make sure you don't miss any future episodes, please go to iTunes or any of the other platforms that you listen on. Search for High Performance Human Triathlon Podcast and then click on the subscribe button. And once you've finished listening to this episode, please could you share it with just one person you think might benefit. And if you've got a couple more minutes, perhaps you could leave me a review on your chosen platform. And if you could do one or both of those, that would be awesome. Before you leave, please make sure you check out those show notes. There's a lot of links on there to the things that Jim and I discussed in the show today and lots more besides, including a link to signing up for my latest newsletter and downloadable document. There's a surprise there on what it is, so you'll have to go and have a look to find out. That's all for this week. I'll have another great guest in 7 days' time, and I hope that you'll be able to join me then. But in the meantime, happy training and enjoy the rest of your week.